content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the New Yorker Hour on the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. I'm Evan Mercer, and today, given that former Mayor Michael Bloomberg has entered the race for president, I will delve into the archives and read a profile of Mayor Bloomberg from the April 22, 2002 edition of the New Yorker magazine. And now, The Mogul Mayor, Mike Bloomberg Adds It All Up, by Elizabeth Colbert. Michael Bloomberg is impatient with words, but likes numbers. His public appearances, while notable for their brevity, nearly always feature some figure or factlet that he finds salient. The size of the city's police force, say, 40,000 officers. Or the year the World Trade Center was conceived, 1960. Or the proportion of New Yorkers who are African American, 1 in 4. Among the first pledges that he made upon taking office was that every month he would post on the Internet an exact headcount of his staff. Current total, 497. Bloomberg himself is New York's 108th mayor, a job he acquired by spending more money on his campaign than anyone in the history of the country, $74 million. He recently turned 60, and based on his stake in Bloomberg LP, the privately held financial data empire that he founded, he is, according to Forbes, the 72nd richest person in the world, up 10 places from last year. Bloomberg's driver's license puts his height at 5 feet 10, which means that he is either taller than he looks or shorter than he says. His girlfriend, Diana Taylor, is 5'9½", and when they stand next to each other, as the news recently pointed out, she towers over him. Every new mayor recasts the job in his own image. Bloomberg, perhaps not surprisingly, has already pushed this further than most. He has, for example, declined to move into Gracie Mansion. The city-owned residence, completed in 1804, has not, Bloomberg explained, had a facelift for some time. Instead, he has opted to remain in his 5-story townhouse on East 79th Street, which features a foyer done in Egyptian porphyry, French Empire sideboards, and a library whose hue Bloomberg's decorator once compared to a bottle of cognac held up to the light. All glowing cognac colors. Shortly after his victory in November, Bloomberg held an intimate get-acquainted dinner for the 5 borough presidents at his townhouse. He served Chateau Haut-Brion, which retails for at least $150 a bottle, and sent each guest home with a giant cookie decorated in icing with the seal of his or her borough. The 51 members of the city council he invited over for cocktails afterward, some of them wondered about their host's decision to serve caviar at a time when the city seemed headed toward the worst fiscal crisis since perhaps the Depression, but in the end the consensus was that it had been the right thing to do. The mayor has 4 other homes in Westchester, Vail, London, and Bermuda. When he takes the weekend off, he refuses, on principle, to say where he's headed. Bloomberg is the first to point out that, according to the numbers, New York is in deep trouble. In February, when he presented the outline of his spending plan, he dispensed with the usual preliminaries and instead of lowballing the problem, as is City Hall custom, forecast a budget gap bigger than anyone had predicted. Bloomberg put the size of the gap at $4.8 billion, which is, by coincidence, roughly the size of his own personal fortune. To meet a shortfall of this magnitude, he pointed out, sacrifice would be required from everyone. 250,000 people who work for New York City do a pretty good job, he said. So you can't just rush in and say, let's just do things better. Later, the mayor qualified this saying that a more accurate number to use for the city's workforce might be 306,000 or alternatively 363,000. Depending once again on how you count, the mayoralty is either Bloomberg's third or fourth career. In the previous ones, he was so enormously successful that he was often asked to share his secret for getting ahead. Bloomberg is fond of aphorisms, and the advice he used to dispense consisted of lines like, "Always be building, do what you love, bring a gun to a knife fight." Just by virtue of winning the election, he has already exceeded what was expected of him politically, and his first 100 days in office have mostly gone smoothly. As mayor, he has made strong appointments, reorganized City Hall, calmed the bond rating agencies, and reached out to many groups in New York that are not normally considered the constituencies of a Republican billionaire. How he will manage the graver challenges that lie ahead is obviously the central question of the next 4 years. But it is not one that Bloomberg himself seems in any way troubled by. He doesn't have self-doubts, Morris Offit, who runs a capital management firm and is an old friend of the mayor's, told me. There's no hand-wringing. It goes back to the trader's mentality. You take a shot, and if you're wrong, you go on to the next one. On an average day, Bloomberg appears at 3 or 4 events around the city. One morning, not long ago, his first stop was a topping-out ceremony for the huge new AOL Time Warner headquarters, which is rising above Columbus Circle. The project, conceived in a happier, more expansive moment for New York, is also to include condominiums, a Mandarin Oriental Hotel, and a new home for jazz at Lincoln Center. Hundreds of people were milling around the sixth floor of the unfinished building, which, lacking walls, provided a spectacular view of Central Park. As soon as the mayor arrived, wearing a gray suit and tasseled loafers, he was ushered to a makeshift stage. He offered his facklet, declaring, not altogether accurately, 75 years ago next month, there was an American flag raised as part of the topping-out ceremony on the Empire State Building, and added a few upbeat words of praise. We've really got a wonderful thing for our children, and thank you. Eventually, an American flag went up over the building, while Wynton Marsalis played Buddy Bolden's Blues. But by that point, Bloomberg was already long gone. His next stop was a news conference at One Liberty Plaza, a block north of the World Trade site, to announce a construction of a temporary pedestrian bridge over West Street. Since September 11th, large sections of Lower Manhattan have been effectively isolated, first by the wreckage and now by the cleanup effort. Governor George Pataki was also at the news conference, and so was the State Assembly Speaker Sheldon Silver, whose district happens to include the Trade Center site. While the other two men tried to grapple, not altogether successfully, with the gravity of the occasion, Bloomberg was evidently bored. He rocked back and forth on his heels and twice had to stifle a yawn. Bloomberg spoke after Pataki, who is 6'5", and when he got to the lectern, the microphone was pointing at the middle of his forehead. "Well, I see that this podium was set for the governor's height," he observed dryly. The day's third event was a celebration of Chinese New Year out at the public library in Flushing, Queens. Thanks to his policy of not using his police siren, Bloomberg arrived at the library a full hour late, but he received a standing ovation nonetheless. He was introduced by the local city councilman, John Liu, who greeted the crowd in Chinese. Bloomberg began by reading aloud from a proclamation that he had issued on the occasion of the Lunar New Year, but then broke away. Let me just digress for a second and point out to you that in New York City, roughly 11% of the population is of Asian extraction, he said. And John Liu is the first Asian American to be elected either at a state or a city level. Finally, Bloomberg joked, as he often does, about his own ethnic background. Happy New Year, he said. I would love to tell you in Chinese, but John stole my thunder, and my accent is not as good. If you want me to do it in Yiddish, I could probably do better. Bloomberg campaigned for mayor as Rudy Giuliani's successor. One of the slogans was, New York's next step. And in the last days of the campaign, he poured millions of dollars into airing and re-airing a 60-second ad in which Giuliani all but anointed him. When you're actually following Bloomberg around, however, it's hard to see much connection between the two men. Giuliani loved the theater of the mayoralty, the rushing to the emergencies, the issuing of edicts, the public wrangling and denunciations. Just about any event he appeared at, he dominated, partly by virtue of his rhetorical skills, but mostly as a result of his monumental certainty in his own moral rectitude. Bloomberg, by contrast, is the kind of guy who once opened a business meeting with a joke about a nurse who liked to masturbate her patients. Another time, at a sales conference, he reported to have announced, I would like nothing more in life than to have Sharon Stone sit on my face. As a mayor, he has foregone this approach, but still, he resists all forms of pomp or Giulianesque sententiousness. Even as he is speaking, the implicit message seems to be that the real work of his mayoralty is taking place somewhere else. Bloomberg is casual to the point of offhandedness. Often he is referred to as Mayor Mike or simply Mike, and he seems altogether uninterested in the dramatic possibilities of office. Not long ago, I heard him address a group of New York City police officers at a charity dinner. You do something that the rest of us don't have to do, he told them, and there's no easy way to say thank you other than thank you. Bloomberg's last appearance of the day was back in Manhattan at the Plaza Hotel at an awards dinner sponsored by the Jewish Community Relations Council of New York. He arrived at the hotel at around 8:15 and was up on stage by 8:25. The award for community service was going to one of his deputy mayors, Dennis Walcott. Just as I think the best is yet to come for New York City, I think we're going to get the best out of Dennis in the future, the mayor said. He congratulated Walcott and then departed. When the dinner's MC, Neil Cavuto of Fox News, got back to the podium, he made a show of searching for Bloomberg in the crowd. Did the mayor leave already? He asked. I guess he's on his way to Bermuda. Bloomberg was born in 1942 on, as he likes to point out, Valentine's Day. Growing up in Medford, Massachusetts, a mostly blue-collar suburb of Boston, he appears to have enjoyed an all-American childhood, as inflected by a kosher home. Bloomberg's father, William, was an accountant for a dairy, and his mother, Charlotte, was a housewife. Charlotte, who is 93, still lives in the house that the family bought in 1946. While preparing for his bar mitzvah at the local conservative synagogue, Bloomberg sold Christmas wreaths door-to-door to finance summers at Boy Scout camp. The Medford High School yearbook records that in 1960 he was president of the Slide Rule Club. He was also active in the debating society and was described by classmates as argumentative. In college, at Johns Hopkins, Bloomberg majored in engineering. He got mainly C's and was popular. He became one of the first Jewish members of Phi Kappa Psi and later president of the university's Intrafraternity Council. Despite his grades, he managed to get into Harvard Business School, where again he failed to make much impact academically. He graduated in the spring of 1966 with no particular plans, expecting, he is said, to get drafted. If the war in Vietnam or the civil rights movement or the Kennedy assassinations or any of the other extraordinary events of the decade moved Bloomberg in any way, he has never let on. When the draft board classified him 1Y, he has flat feet, he took a job at Salomon Brothers. It was there that he seems to have discovered himself. In those days, Salomon was a second or even third-class firm, not in financial terms, but in social ones. It was a trading house, known primarily for its bond business, while the more genteel firms, like Morgan Stanley, were investment banking houses. One of Solomon's unofficial mottos was, "Dress British, think Yiddish." Risk-taking of all sorts was celebrated, and so were most forms of aggression, screaming, cursing, bullying, backstabbing. To succeed on Solomon's trading floor, one of the manager's partners once declared, a person had to come to work early each morning, ready to bite the ass off a bear. Everyone at Solomon worked hard, and Bloomberg worked hard to outdo everyone else. His first assignment was in the cage, an unair-conditioned bank vault where he stood around in his underwear, counting out stock and bond certificates by hand. His next was filing in the purchase and sales department. He used to get to the office earlier than anyone except the head of the firm, Billy Solomon, and stay later than anyone except Solomon's heir apparent, John Gutfreund. When Gutfreund got into a cab to go home, he would often give Bloomberg a lift. Bloomberg eventually worked his way onto the equities desk, where he called himself a trader, though really he was a salesman. He specialized in block trades, buying tens or even hundreds of thousands of shares from one institutional client, and then turning around and selling them to another. "We could sell anything to anybody," he observed in his 1997 autobiography, Bloomberg by Bloomberg, referring to himself and the head of Solomon's block trading operation, Jay Perry. "We just did what all great salespeople do. We presented everything we had and then highlighted whatever facts enabled customers to convince themselves they were getting a good deal. It has a strong specialist behind it," I'd tell one buyer who might not have the slightest idea why the specialist mattered. The chart pattern looks like a breakout," Perry would declare for those who believed, "the trend's my friend." Block trading was, at the time, a relatively new and lucrative enterprise, and Bloomberg loved everything about it. He loved the newness, the riskiness, the money. "I was the fair-haired boy, the block trading superstar," he writes. "I was the pet of its two top executives. I greeted all important visiting customers, got interviewed by every newspaper that mattered, and had a great social life playing the role of Wall Street power broker to the hilt. More than a legend in my own mind." Not everyone at the firm was quite as impressed with Bloomberg as he was. "I'd be shocked if you interviewed people from Solomon if you found anyone who could even tell you what the contribution he made," Richard Grandjean, a Bloomberg admirer and former colleague, told me. When Bloomberg rose to partner in 1972 at the age of 30, he became the third-ranking man on the equities desk, working under Perry and another legendarily smart and also legendarily difficult senior partner, Richard Rosenthal. For several years, the three men engaged in a round-robin power struggle. In one particularly raw moment, Perry dumped the contents of Bloomberg's desk onto the floor while he was off attending a breakfast meeting. Until finally, in 1979, Bloomberg lost out. He was forced off the equities desk and given the job of running the firm's information systems. Wall Street was, at that point, in the very earliest stages of computerization. Traders were still working out bond yields on oversized desktop calculators, and the move was recognized by everyone at the firm as a demotion. It's a kind of job where, when you hear someone getting it, you're not going to be surprised if 2 days later they leave. Grandjean said, "For whatever reason, Bloomberg stayed on. 2 years later, he was fired." Bloomberg has always attributed his dismissal to his candor. He used to declare openly, he says, that he could run the company better than Gutfreund. Others explain it in more prosaic terms. Salomon was in the process of merging with Fibro, a publicly traded commodities company, and Bloomberg, as the head of information systems, was not producing any revenue. When I asked Gutfreund for his version of events, he refused to comment. A few years ago, he told the Boston Globe that he did not intend to engage in fine-tuning the myth of Michael Bloomberg. Bloomberg claims to have been mostly concerned about how his then-wife, Sue Brown, would react to his change in status. The couple, who have two grown daughters, divorced in 1993. And so he paid a visit to a furrier. A sable jacket seemed to say, "No sweat, we can still eat, we're still players." His next move was to found his own firm. Bloomberg LP has its headquarters in a black glass box of a building on Park Avenue at 59th Street. On the ground floor, facing out onto the sidewalk, 16 screens show fluctuating stock and commodity prices, bond yields, and the exchange rates. Inside the lobby, there are 6 more screens showing much the same information. Upstairs, every receptionist stands behind her own screen, and in every direction there are more screens, big ones and little ones, displaying all Bloomberg all the time. Even in the ladies' room, there are screens set into the mirrors above the sinks. Not long ago, I went to the headquarters to get a demonstration of the firm's proprietary data system from a salesman named Ken Napolitano. On my way to meet him, I passed hundreds of cubicles with 2 and sometimes 4 computer screens, a food court loaded with fresh fruit and candy, and a zipper display running an announcement in red lights. Amy Johnston sells 4 more terminals at American Express to their equity research department. The Bloomberg system used to be available only over a dedicated terminal. Today, it is offered through subscribers' PCs. Napolitano led me into a small conference room that had a large projection screen on one wall and, on the table, a keyboard. Much like a pianist practicing scales, he began with a demonstration of some of the system's basic functions. He looked up some bond prices and, for the fun of it, pulled up some historical data. On January 4th, 1955, I learned, the Dow Jones Industrial Average stood at 406.16 points. Bonds, and more particularly the curious subjectivity involved in pricing them, are at the heart of Bloomberg's business, just as they were at the heart of Solomon's. Many factors affect a bond's value, including the interest rates it offers, the time of maturity, and the going rate for the government issues. But since there is nothing like the New York Stock Exchange or NASDAQ for bonds, there is no way to know exactly what a bond is worth. John McConville, the editor of Inside Market Data, remembers Bloomberg's recounting to him a conversation he had once had with a bond trader. Bloomberg asked how the price had been set for a particular bond. The trader replied that he had made it up. The data Bloomberg offers its subscribers are intended to put a limit on such inventiveness. To show me how, Napolitano chose a corporate bond issue from AT&T with a maturity date of May 15, 2025. The first screens he pulled up showed the bond's ratings by Moody's and Standard & Poor's, and its average and current yields compared with those of a Treasury note. Next, Napolitano produced a graph showing how telecommunications company bonds, in general, stacked up against Treasury notes. Then he pulled up a figure called the Bloomberg Fair Value for the AT&T bond, which was based on prices for similar bonds and represented the firm's best estimate of its worth. Napolitano then looked up AT&T stock and, clicking through more screens, created a chart showing how it had performed against that of other telecommunications companies. Finally, He performed what is called an option-adjusted spread analysis, which somehow factored out the risk that the AT&T bond would be called before its maturity date and allowed its value to be compared directly with that of the so-called bullet bonds. Napolitano was a good salesman, and as the numbers flashed by, sometimes in spreadsheet form, sometimes as a graph, it was easy to see why someone investing, say, a few billion dollars would consider the service's monthly fee of $1,285 per workstation money well spent. Bloomberg's first customers, outside of Merrill Lynch, which still owns a one-fifth stake in his company, were large institutional investors, like pension funds. Initially, the service simply allowed them to make better informed decisions. Later, it began to change the world it was describing. As it became more difficult to exploit customers' ignorance, bond spreads, the gap between what a firm is willing to pay for a particular issue and how much it is asking to sell it, narrowed. This, in turn, cut down on profit margins for traders, meaning that, in a roundabout way, Bloomberg's success came at the expense of the very group of people who had fired him. Bloomberg has always maintained that he came up with the idea for Bloomberg LP only after his dismissal. But it is hard to imagine that the notion hadn't at least crossed his mind prior to that. In his last year at Salomon, after all, he had been working on organizing stock and bond data electronically for the firm. In the 80s, Bloomberg built his business and sold the services he had developed at Salomon back to Salomon. Gottfreund told me, "We paid for it twice." I congratulate him. In February 1990, in honor of Bloomberg's 48th birthday, one of his top staff members, Elizabeth DeMars, put together a book entitled The Portable Bloomberg. Dedicated to the president of the greatest company in the world, it contained 32 pages of his collected wit and wisdom, and was illustrated with pen and ink drawings of Bloomberg in, among other outfits, gladiator gear. In a prefatory note, DeMars, who is now the president of an internet consumer finance firm, Bankrate.com, wrote, "Yes, these are all actual quotes. No, nothing has been embellished or exaggerated, and yes, some things were too outrageous to include." A lot of the portable Bloomberg consists of off-color jokes, and when New York published excerpts last summer, shortly before the mayoral primary, it created a brief sensation. There are quotations on Merry Old England. There are quotations on Merry Old England. There's only one queen in Buckingham Palace. The rest are in Trafalgar Square. On women. If women wanted to be appreciated for their brains, they'd go to the library instead of Bloomingdale's. And on marriage. Sex with someone you love is sex with someone you love. The pluses are you don't have to buy dinner, and the only thing you catch is calluses. In the section on the Bloomberg Terminal, Bloomberg is quoted as saying, "It will do everything, including giving you a blowjob. I guess that puts a lot of you girls out of business." On the campaign trail, Bloomberg characterized the remarks as borscht belt jokes and said he didn't remember having made them. Also surfacing in the booklet is a business philosophy. "Whenever one of my employees designs a form or writes a memo, I walk out into the hallway and make a big deal of tearing it up. The last thing we need are lots of forms and procedures and policies." How do you motivate someone? Bloomberg is quoted as asking. Simple. Are they addicted to three meals a day? Bloomberg gave up day-to-day responsibility for Bloomberg LP last year in order to campaign for mayor. Until then, he ran the firm according to a strong, if quirky, set of management principles. Frederick Taylor meets B.F. Skinner. Bloomberg himself sat at a desk in the middle of a sea of other desks, an arrangement that he called an open plan. He limited elevator service between floors so that everyone would have to come in by the same entrance and climb the same stairs, and provided free food so that his employees would be less inclined to leave the building. There were no titles or individual offices, and anyone who wanted privacy had to reserve a conference room. Bloomberg had made these out of glass. He also had saltwater aquariums installed at key locations, because fish, he said, provide relaxation. Bloomberg is still awaiting a ruling from the city's Conflicts of Interest Board on his continued ownership of the firm, and theoretically, at least, could be told to sell it. The open plan was intended to inspire teamwork. You're part of the board or you're not, is how one former employee described it, and at the same time cut down on pointless formalities. Anybody at the firm could walk right up and speak with Bloomberg. Those who were too shy to approach him were likely to bump into him when they were picking up a free bag of Doritos. He was constantly in touch, Doug McGill, a former London bureau chief for Bloomberg News, told me. I could literally call him up at any time, and I always got right through to him. Every summer, there was a picnic for the entire staff at Bloomberg's. At Bloomberg's Westchester estate, with a petting zoo for the kids. Bloomberg encouraged his guests to come in T-shirts and shorts, which is what he wore. The company's strategy was relatively straightforward: offer the best and charge for it. As a matter of principle, Bloomberg never gave volume discounts, and he was constantly adding new features to the data service, which every subscriber was obliged to finance. I follow the trader's adage, if you can't move something, mark it up, not down, he is quoted as saying in the portable Bloomberg. He paid his own employees well and in return expected them routinely to put in 11-hour days. What you cannot question about this guy is his dedication to high quality and to winning at any cost, or almost any cost, observed Tom Calandra, a former Bloomberg News reporter who is now editor-in-chief of CBS MarketWatch. He's an overachiever. He's an achiever. And so far, nothing he's done has resulted in tragedy. Throughout the 90s, Bloomberg LP expanded rapidly. At the start of the decade, it had 10,000 subscribers and estimated annual revenues of under $150 million. By the end, it had 164,000 subscribers and annual revenues of $2.3 billion. In the process, it crushed several of its competitors, including Dow Jones' Telerate service. Whether or not Bloomberg himself was entirely responsible for this success, he did not, for example, do any of the technical work. He invariably received all the credit. When you get hired, you get this whole stack of publicity, Calandra recalled. Every single article is about Mike Bloomberg. Every article. And it's been like that for 10 years. It's all about Mike. And it's always has been about him. Bloomberg played such a big role that even his personality tended to be viewed as corporate policy, including his bluntness. His favorite jokes were of the, what's the difference between a woman's genital and parsley variety, and he told them pretty much without regard for who was listening. He freely discussed his own sexual exploits and those, real or imagined, of his employees. At least some of his staff members joined in. Around the office, the phrase, I'd F-word that in a minute, was voiced so routinely that to save time it was shortened to in a minute. The atmosphere at Bloomberg LP was cited in three sex discrimination suits filed against the firm. One case was brought by a saleswoman, Sakiko Sakai Garrison, who alleged that she had been repeatedly harassed and then forced to leave after complaining about it. Among her accusations was the charge that Bloomberg had greeted the news that she was pregnant with the remark, "Kill it." Bloomberg has denied saying this, and during the mayoral campaign, produced the results of a polygraph to back up his assertion. Nevertheless, he settled the suit out of court for an undisclosed, but by all accounts, substantial sum. In a second suit, a saleswoman named Mary Ann Olszewski charged that she had been raped by a colleague while the two were out of town together on a business trip. Eventually, this suit was dismissed after the plaintiff missed various filing deadlines, but not before Bloomberg had been deposed by her lawyer. An excerpt of the deposition was published in the Village Voice. Lawyer: what would constitute satisfactory proof to you that the allegation was genuine? Bloomberg: I guess an unimpeachable third-party witness. Lawyer: do you think that's possible in most instances of date rape? Bloomberg: I don't know whether this was date rape. Lawyer: describe for me your conception of how there could be a third-party witness to confirm or deny the truthfulness of her allegations. Bloomberg: there are times when three people are together. Lawyer: other than those circumstances when a woman claiming rape was in the presence of more than one man, what other? Bloomberg: why does it have to be a man? Lawyer: have you ever read any psychosocial literature about the subject of rape? Bloomberg: there was a cover story in one of the weekly news magazines last month. I'm sure I glanced through it. Lawyer: which one? Bloomberg: Time, U.S. News, or Newsweek? For all I know, it was all three. They all do the same things. Bloomberg's budget presentation in February was the longest sustained public address of his mayoralty so far, and it wasn't so much an address as a lesson in municipal finance. The mayor spoke for nearly 2 hours in City Hall's Blue Room as various charts and graphs were projected on a screen behind him. What we're going to do is show you how this next year, fiscal 2003, which starts July 1st, we are going to have a deficit of approximately $4.8 billion, he started off. Now, whether it's 4.7 or 4.9, 4.6 or 5.0 is not material. There's no way you can tell exactly. It's very hard to predict the future. And when you talk about whatever gaps we're going to see in 2004 and 2005, you get less and less confidence in the numbers. The economy may get better. The economy may get worse. We may have one-time terrible events like 9/11. We may have nothing but good times. You cannot predict. The mayor went on. So we are going to show you how to balance a $4.8 billion deficit with no new taxes. We are going to have reductions and efficiencies. We are not going to rely on one-time things. We can't rely on one-time shots. We don't have a budget deficit for just 2003. The deficit that we think we're going to have in 2003 is about $4.8 billion. 2004 has a bigger one. 2005 has an even bigger one. If you try to balance the budget by one-time shots and postponing your expenses, it's just going to make the next year even worse. So we have to face reality. Bloomberg's preliminary budget was, in fact, somewhat less realistic than he claimed. It included, for example, several projected savings of the sort that are never realized, as his own administration later tacitly acknowledged. It also featured $1.5 billion in borrowing to cover current operating expenses, a practice that has quite possibly been justified by recent events, but that under ordinary circumstances would not be allowed. Still, his budget was much praised, especially for its even-handedness. The mayor proposed more or less across-the-board cuts, even in normally hallowed programs like senior citizen centers. The budget that we're going to show you hurts everybody, he said. We don't think it hurts anybody fatally. Except for higher taxes, which he ruled out not so much on philosophical grounds as on practical ones. You would scare people away and you would scare the rating agencies, he professed himself, willing to consider any reasonable alternatives. I do not have all the good ideas, he observed. A pragmatic approach to a bad news budget was the Times assessment. Bloomberg switched parties before the mayoral election in order to avoid a crowded Democratic primary. The change took place at the last possible moment allowed by New York election law, and it might have caused more controversy had he ever shown an interest in ideology of any sort. In office, Bloomberg has remained strikingly noncommittal. He has appointed his commissioners apparently without regard to political orientation. It is likely that several didn't even vote for him, and by all accounts he has given them a great deal of latitude. One told me that the mayor's instructions to him could be summed up as, "It's your agency, don't screw it up." In contrast to Giuliani, who took his principles so seriously that he didn't speak to anyone he disapproved of, Bloomberg makes a point of meeting with everyone. When, for example, the verdicts against three officers convicted in the Abner Luima case were thrown out, Bloomberg appeared first at the 70th Precinct House in Flatbush, where the torture had occurred, to show his solidarity with the police. Then, that same afternoon, he went to a black church in Brownsville to show his support for the community that had felt betrayed by the police. On the morning of the St. Patrick's Day parade, he held a celebratory breakfast at Gracie Mansion and invited both the parade's organizers and members of a gay group that the organizers had excluded from the parade. Bloomberg has not only visited the Reverend Al Sharpton's headquarters in Harlem, but he has promised, if invited, to come back every year. The greatest thing he's done is he's changed the climate of the city so that people are no longer frightened of the mayor, former Mayor Ed Koch, Coate told me. Aptly enough, since he seems to see his primary role as a managerial, Bloomberg's inaugural gesture was to rearrange City Hall. He abandoned the traditional executive offices across from the Blue Room and instead installed himself and his deputies, open plan style, in cubicles upstairs. He also brought in free food and fish tanks. His current priority is winning control over the city's school system, a goal that previous mayors have also pursued unsuccessfully. Bloomberg maintains that he is ultimately going to win this battle. The final decision rests with Albany, and has already announced his intention to move the school bureaucracy out of its current headquarters in Brooklyn and into the Tweed Courthouse in Lower Manhattan. Though the old courthouse is just about renovated at a cost of $90 million and had been promised to the Museum of the City of New York, Bloomberg has proposed turning it back into offices, complete with cubicles. That Bloomberg rarely addresses the emotional or moral complexity of life in the city is undoubtedly a rhetorical failure. He seems, at least in public, almost incapable of expressing strong feelings or beliefs or of eliciting them from others. After the mayor had delivered a particularly perfunctory address, this one to a group of school children, I heard one City Hall reporter joke, "It's his thank you for inviting me speech, which consists of, thank you for inviting me." At the same time, this limitation is one that, given Bloomberg's priorities, may not be all that significant. As far as he is concerned, the only reason to talk about a problem is to solve it, the corollary of which is that the only problems that can be solved are really worth talking about. "I am going to show you how we got into this situation," the mayor said matter-of-factly when he presented his budget, and a solution to work our ways out of this situation. Every year, the National Lesbian and Gay Journalists Association holds a benefit in New York to support, among other programs, the group's national convention, its style book on gay and lesbian terminology, and its student outreach effort. This year, Bloomberg LP was one of the event's gold-level sponsors, and the mayor was a featured speaker at the cocktail reception, which took place at the offices of MTV in Times Square. Often, Bloomberg is described as a media mogul, and this is at least partially accurate. In addition to the financial data service, which generates nearly all the firm's profits, Bloomberg LP comprises a wire service, Bloomberg News, Bloomberg Television, Bloomberg Radio, and a consumer magazine division which publishes titles like Bloomberg Markets, Bloomberg Wealth Manager, and Bloomberg Personal Finance. The company also has a books division which publishes, among other things, New Yorker cartoon collections. All in all, the firm employs 1,700 journalists in 85 bureaus around the world, and at the cocktail reception, several Bloomberg reporters were in attendance. "Thank you for having me," the mayor told the journalists who were gathered at little round tables. "I was here last year. Since then, I have come out of the closet. It's true. I have finally admitted that I'm a Republican, and the press has cut me a lot of slack since then, particularly on weekends. They really do leave me alone." Speaking, as usual, without notes, he continued, "Oscar Wilde once said, 'We are dominated by journalism.' And that is both the good news and the bad news. The good news is that journalism is what keeps us a free society. If it weren't for a free, aggressive, investigatory press, we would really have totalitarianism. And we should never forget that, no matter how many times we get annoyed with the press for intrusiveness or whatever. And I do think sometimes, and this is my personal experience, you have a right to ask. But the great thing about the First Amendment is I have a right not to answer. You have a right to write it. I have a right not to read it." And that was the way I got through my campaign. I basically said I wasn't going to read any of this stuff anymore. And it's amazing. If you don't read it, life goes on. He concluded, "Anyways, congratulations to all of you." In general, Bloomberg has a hard time masking his feelings toward the journalists who now trail him. Not long ago, he went record shopping to demonstrate his support for merchants in Lower Manhattan and flipped through a rack of CDs as the cameras clicked away furiously. I happened to be standing nearby when he muttered to no one in particular, "The dumbest things in the world. They're taking pictures of it." He bought two CDs by Crosby, Stills, and Nash. On another occasion, he was heading into a routine press conference at a Manhattan middle school when he ran into someone he knew. "You're not joining this gaggle," he exclaimed. Doubtless, it is aggravating to be covered by the New York press. And while Bloomberg has been widely praised for his budget, his appointments, and his restructuring of City Hall, he has also been taunted. The first time he suddenly dropped out of view for the weekend without letting reporters know about his whereabouts, the Post ran a picture of a milk carton with his face on it saying, "Have you seen me?" The next weekend he disappeared. A Post photographer showed up at the home of the deputy mayor for operations, Mark Shaw, in Queens. The paper ran a picture of a disheveled-looking Shaw who appeared at the door in jeans and a T-shirt, above a caption identifying him as "the man in charge when the mayor's gone." The conceit was then picked up by David Letterman, who broadcast Shaw's photograph as the lead-in to a top 10 list of the ways New York City is different when this guy's in charge. Number one, first city official since Koch to take a leak in the Hudson. Yet, Bloomberg's disdain for the press clearly goes beyond the missing person gags. If I had a heart attack in the sales department, everyone would come around and immediately give me CPR, he once announced to a group of reporters at Bloomberg LP. If I had a heart attack in the newsroom, you all would stand around and scribble notes. During the mayoral race, I asked him for his reflections on the campaign, and his response was to reflect on the stupidity of reporters. "I don't know whether it's just that they're not all that smart, or maybe they just don't think it sells," he told me. "But there is a focus on finding something wrong." His own media empire notwithstanding, Bloomberg clearly doesn't like the focus on what is wrong. In my conversations with his associates, a recurrent theme was his lack of interest in any kind of self-criticism or even analysis. This quality, several friends of his insisted, was essential to his success. In his own mind, he really doesn't feel there's anything that he can't accomplish, Morris Offit told me. He has these God-given talents. Why not take advantage of them? It's very straightforward. If someone told me that Michael was getting some kind of therapy, I'd be the most surprised person in the world. Matthew Winkler is the editor-in-chief of Bloomberg News and wrote Bloomberg's autobiography with him. He told me that during their collaboration, Bloomberg kept trying to add exclamation points to the manuscript. He's his own hero, Winkler said of his old boss. As a result, he doesn't have to be that introspective. Life is a series of goals to be achieved. He defines the goals and then does everything he can to achieve them. He went on, so it's relatively uncomplicated, and that's why it works. That's why he works, because he doesn't spend a lot of time wondering if it's all meaningless. Bloomberg devotes the last chapter of his autobiography to philanthropy, entitled Wealth, Wisdom, and Work. It reads like a self-help manual for the fantastically wealthy. After you've gotten used to living like a king, what do? Bloomberg asks at one point. First, forget about worrying over taxes, he answers. Second, don't spoil your family. Third, be selfish. Buy yourself enormous pleasure. Give most of your wealth to charity. Bloomberg has been enormously generous, contributing to everything from his mother's synagogue in Medford to the Harlem Opera. A list of donations released by his campaign last summer show that in the previous 12-month period, he had made gifts totaling more than $100 million to nearly 600 groups. Though he is not much of a museum-goer and by his own account sleeps at the opera, he was until recently on the board of the Metropolitan Museum of Art and of Lincoln Center. Bloomberg himself underwrote the museum's renovation of its arms and armor gallery, and his company underwrote Lincoln Center's summer season. Bloomberg has even endowed a fellowship at Harvard for the professional study of giving. Every 2 years, this chair passes from one school at Harvard to another, he writes. And so every 24 months, a new person will study, teach, research, and write from a new perspective about my interest, philanthropy. Will they make great contributions to society? You bet. Will there be great leverage to continue the work I love by teaching many? For sure. Will my family get enjoyment, satisfaction, admiration? Absolutely. Bloomberg's view of philanthropy, upbeat and uncomplicated, matches perhaps, not surprisingly, his view of himself. Giving to others is not about guilt or ethical obligation or even identification with those who are suffering. It is, rather, another form of self-realization. In his words, the greatest satisfaction available for cash today. Even as he was preparing to run for mayor last year, Bloomberg was quietly at work on his most ambitious philanthropic project to date. The mayor is the chairman of the board of trustees of Johns Hopkins, his alma mater, and for years has been a major benefactor of the university. His largest donations have been to Hopkins School of Public Health, which is now named after him. Last year, he held a series of discussions with the school's dean, Dr. Alfred Sommer, in which he expressed interest in making a further contribution to public health that would change the world. Sommer traveled to New York with half a dozen other eminent research scientists from Hopkins. The group stayed at the Algonquin and sat at the round table, trying to come up with a proposal. When the scientists presented their ideas to Bloomberg in a conference room at Bloomberg LP, none of their suggestions seemed to him quite big enough, except for one, which was to eliminate a deadly disease. Sommer declined to specify which disease, but last May, Johns Hopkins announced an anonymous $100 million gift to set up a malaria research institute. Wouldn't it be great to say you saved more lives than anybody in the history of the world? Bloomberg asked shortly before the institute was announced. 6 months later, he made another anonymous donation of $10 million to the Carnegie Corporation to assist cultural institutions hurt by the September 11th attack. 100 days into his mayoralty, Bloomberg is still introduced as someone who did not need to run for office, and clearly this is the case. He already had a great life. Let me put it this way, he once said. I am a single, straight billionaire in Manhattan. What do you think? It's a wet dream. New York, meanwhile, even before September 11th, was headed toward hard times. In the months since the attack, 98,000 jobs have left the city, many of them never to return. And the very future of downtown as the world's financial center has been cast into doubt. Bloomberg didn't run for mayor despite the difficulties of the job, but one has to assume because of them. He has always been drawn to new challenges, to munificent gestures, and to danger. Did I want to risk an embarrassing and costly failure? He once observed about his decision to start Bloomberg LP. Absolutely. While he was still at Salomon Brothers, Bloomberg took up flying. One weekend, he set off up the Connecticut coast in a rented helicopter. He was just off of Norwalk, over a tiny island in Long Island Sound, when his engine conked out. Black smoke filled the cockpit, and the helicopter began to tumble out of the sky. Bloomberg just barely managed to maneuver it onto the island, the tail dangling over the water, and bail out. More recently, when Bloomberg was taking his nephew on a sightseeing flight to Manhattan, a propeller on his private airplane failed. He was forced to make an emergency landing at Westchester Airport. But, as he later informed his sister, any landing you walk away from is a good one. Well, we have time for our one cartoon from the November 11th, 2019 edition of The New Yorker. We see a man up in the clouds, long flowing hair and beard, sitting at a desk. Nameplate is God. An angel secretary is sitting across from him, taking dictation. God says, "And for being careless with the environment, put tiny, hard-to-remove stickers on all of their fruit." Well, we've run out of time for today's broadcast. I hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as I enjoyed reading it. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Today's broadcast, as well as all previous New Yorker readings, are available as podcasts on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Well, that's it for today. Until next time, this is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.